Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lynn Curtis. I am co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum, along with Ann Smith, who's back here. And this program tonight is also in conjunction with the Commonwealth Club's environmental forum. So now I'd like to introduce our speaker, John Muir Laws. John Muir Laws is a naturalist, educator, and artist with degrees in conservation and resource studies from the University of California, Berkeley, in wildlife biology from the University of Montana, Missoula, and certification in scientific illustration from the University of California, Santa Cruz. He is a research associate with the California Academy of Sciences. His field guide, which you saw as you came in, The Laws Field Guide to the Sierra Nevada, was published in 2007 with Heyday Books and the California Academy of Sciences as co-publishers. The guidebook contains 2,710 color illustrations and documents over 1,700 species. The paintings currently on the wall in this exhibition are the ones that formed. These are the originals that went into the book. So, on this Earth Day, it is my pleasure to introduce a great steward of the planet, John Muir Laws.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. It's a real honor, and I've been listening to Commonwealth's microphone.
We'll start again. Hi there. I'm Jack Laws, and I'm really delighted to be here. I've been listening to Commonwealth Club presentations on the radio for years and years and always heard that gavel, and actually to see it come down, it's just really exciting for me. So this will be a lot of fun. And events like this always attract just a collection of people who know and love the Sierra Nevada. So it is a great way to spend Earth Day with like-minded people. So thank you all for coming out, and I wish everybody a happy Earth Day. I am I guess some people have described me as a biodiversity evangelist. I got absolutely hooked deeply from my heart by nature and natural history at a very, very early age. My mom, who's right there in the back in the orange coat, and my dad right there were both very interested in natural history. My mom was an amateur botanist, and my dad a birder. So whenever we'd go out as a family together, I'd kind of be doing this, getting birder botanist whiplash in the neck. But it wasn't pushed on me, but it was just a part of the flow of all of our family activities. To get down on our bellies and to get out a hand lens and look closer and to look closer. And that love just grew with me as I got older and older. And then in high school, I was attending Urban High School, and that's here in San Francisco. And we had a class where for the several months we just hiked down the John Muir Trail. And all of our coursework tied into what we saw and what we experienced. And as I went, I began to fantasize about two things. One was the food that I would eat when I would get back home. And the second was my dream field guide, because I had my backpack loaded down with all these books about natural history to help me understand what I saw. And that dream stuck with me for years and years and years. And it was finally the inspiration of my grandmother, who was a watercolor painter, that helped me realize that everybody has a fantasy about what they would like to do someday. But, are we recording? Oh, great. Can I still be heard? Great. We all have a fantasy about what we would like to do someday, this sort of dream project. But it's always going to stay this fantasy unless you just begin. So I quit my job and filled my backpack up with biscuits and drawing paper and headed off to the Sierra Nevada, and for the next 6 years, I painted wildflowers in the Sierra Nevada all summer long, And my I would start at high elevation in at low elevation in the Southern Sierra and kind of work my way north as the season warmed up, and then go back again to get the late season stuff. And as I'd slowly move upslope as spring would move upslope. And I was interested in the wildflowers, the birds, all these sorts of things. I always sort of found that, you know, whatever, if let's say some trip you bring all of your botany guides with you, that's guaranteed to be the time that something else shows up that is in none of your flower books. And you're thinking, you know, this is the time I really should have brought that Sibley or whatever other field guide you wanted to bring with you. So my thought was I wanted everything, but I also wanted it to be lightweight enough for me to bring in my backpack. Because at a certain point, what was a field guide becomes a coffee table book. And so figuring out that threshold was really interesting. It also was just such a delightful 6 years of my life, just getting to spend my summers romping around in meadows and looking closely at things. And the more I looked, the more deeply I fell in love with what I saw. And so coming out of that experience on this side, what I am devoting myself to is trying to share that love with people up and down the state. In specific, I'm working right now with school children to help them learn how to use drawing and sketching as a way of looking more closely at nature. And my goal is to get sets of these field guides into every school in the Sierra Nevada. And so far, I've been able to, I had funding to do two of them, but within the last several months, it looks like I now have funding to do about 30 more, and that's really exciting. So I want to get these books into the hands of the kids who live in these areas to help them understand what's right there in their backyard, because if we know it and appreciate it and understand it, that helps us fall in love with it, and then we can become stewards of what we see. So what I'm going to do tonight with you is take you on a journey through some of the different species that I find as I'm hiking around in the Sierra Nevada and look at ways that they relate to each other. Some of the ways are surprising and wonderful, and they're beautiful, beautiful animals. I think that the more that we understand things scientifically, it doesn't take the magic away from appreciating these things. It just helps us understand and appreciate these things even more deeply. So I'm going to start with one species, and hopefully at the end of the evening, we're going to come around back to that same one. And I'm going to start you in Tuolumne Meadows. You look around Tuolumne Meadows in Yosemite, and you're standing in a forest of trees with short needles and bundles of two. And this is the last sort of solid forest before you get into that subalpine region and get into the land where trees won't grow anymore. But the last solid forest is of these trees, and the needles always help me remember the name of the tree. This one, it's the only species of tree up there that has two needles. So you take those two needles, you bend them, you can make an L for a lodgepole. So that's how you can remember these trees. So the lodgepole pine, these little tiny cones, if you start looking around really carefully on the needles themselves, on old trees deep in the forest, the branches are only up high, but you go to younger trees, you can look at those branches right at ground level, and what you'll discover is that some of them, you can see little brown zones at the tips of those needles. And if you take those needles and hold them up to the light, you can actually see transmitted through them, there's a little hollow chamber in there. There's something inside those needles nibbling away. And what it is the larva of a little tiny moth, a needle miner moth that is nibbling away its entire sort of pupal life inside the body of that needle. And this is really cool because the protection of that needle also helps it survive harsh Sierra winters. So it's got food inside there, it's got shelter. And because these little moths are nibbling away all the way through the winter, that actually helps other species survive the winter because the mountain chickadees are hip to this. If you go snowshoeing in the middle of winter, you'll hear chickadees. That cheeseburger call, right? You'll hear chickadees in the trees above you. And you're thinking to yourself, well, why are chickadees still here? They're insect eaters. And with the snow on the trees, all the insects must be gone. But they're getting these little larvae that are in these safe little protective capsules. They look for the same things that you can, these little needles with the brown tip. They hold it in their beak, twist it. Out pops the little bit of food, and they're on to the next tree. So they're going branch to branch, inspecting needle by needle to get their meal. Especially after a snowstorm when they're really hungry, these animals are particularly active. And these little moths, they usually do not cause serious harm for the tree. They're usually just around in low levels. Some years back, there was an outbreak of these. But usually they're there at low levels, but they can weaken the resistance of a tree. And a weak tree is then vulnerable for other species to move in. You may have gone through a forest and found places where there's little globs of red-brown sap on the side of a tree. These are places where small wood-boring beetles are working their way into the wood of a tree. If you look on a downed tree, you can find these sorts of patterns on the wood underneath. And what this is a beautiful calligraphy that tells a family story. This is essentially the family tree of one of these little wood-boring beetles. The males come and they dig a little chamber like this. And then they sit there and they release pheromones from the entrance of this little pit. And these pheromones are of interest to both females and males. The females, of course, are coming there to mate. So they can come there, find the male, and then each female will dig her own little tunnel off like that. And as she does, she's laying eggs along either side of the tunnel, right? And so when those hatch, the little larvae start to chew their way out, and you can see them getting larger here in the shape of the chew that they're making. So the further they go out, the larger they get. They then pupate here and can emerge. The story gets even more interesting, because if you're a beetle and you go chewing your way into a tree, the tree doesn't like this. And so if it's relatively healthy, it'll just flood you out with sap. End of the story for you, because you'll then be stuck in a glob of sap on the side of the tree. A little woodpecker or a brown creeper will come along, or a nuthatch will pick you off, and you're food for them. So the beetles, the male that starts to chew into the tree, also sends out a pheromone signal to other males. And what it says is, everybody in the forest here, let's all attack this one tree. Not that one right next to it. This one right here. All the beetles whoop, go to that, and they can overwhelm the defensive strategy of the tree. And together, because they're all hitting it, the tree doesn't have enough sap to get rid of them. And they have another bit of ammunition up their sleeve. See this little depression in the back of the beetle? This is a little storage place for fungal spores. And they have fungus, a blue stain fungus, that collects back here. And when they go to drill into a tree, they inoculate that part of the tree with the fungus. The fungus clogs up the vascular system of the tree. So they're using this fungus to cork up the tree so they won't get flooded out. And they're all hitting the tree at the same time. Interestingly enough, the last cool thing is the little baby beetle, the last final thing it does before it leaves the tree, it turns around, gets some fungus right in its backside, and flies off to start the whole thing over again. Really, really, really cool. This is happening all the time in a forest at sort of moderate levels. And what kind of kicks these populations back is wintertime. So if they were able to get off a bunch of generations, they could, of course, overwhelm all the trees in the forest. But because winter comes along, it kicks them back. That's one reason that biologists are worried about a shorter winter in the Sierra Nevada. How is that actually going to affect the beetles? And in some parts of the world, up in Canada, they're seeing multiple generations of these beetles in a single year. And we are also really concerned about that coming to our state. Well, these beetles are also a banquet for other species. Woodpeckers will flake off the bark and eat all the little beetles off. So these beetles are also supporting other species of animals that are in the forest. The woodpeckers don't have to knock off all the bark because they have a special mechanism in their how their tongue is set up that allows them to more easily get the food. I'm going to need two hands for this. So put this one down, bend this one over here. So if this is my tongue, right, lying here in the bottom of my beak, if I'm like a human being, it's attached right here at the back of my mouth. Right? But if I'm a woodpecker, instead of being attached back here, it actually goes behind the skull in a lubricated tube, forks, comes over the top of the head, and inserts in the right nostril on the front of the face. So what it can do then is when it opens its mouth, it can take its tongue, which has these backwards-facing hairs on the tip of it, and shoot this thing out like that. So just an amazing tongue mechanism. So if they get a little bit of a hole there, they can shoot this up in there and get all the rest of the grubs that are hiding inside there. It's a pretty cool trick. These woodpeckers will also make their homes in the tree, and maybe some people have had the pleasure of having a woodpecker move into their house. All right, they will drill holes in trees, essentially making a terrific fortress to raise a family. If you're hiking through the forest, you can tell when there's a woodpecker nest nearby because all the chicks are in it screaming away. Chicks that are in little cup nests out in the forests are completely silent. All right, make a little bit of noise when a parent shows up with some food, but mostly just open their mouths and do that because they don't want to attract a predator. But you can get away with making all that noise if you are living in a wood fort. And these woodpeckers make a new wood fort each year, meaning that the forest is now filled with these used wood forts, which is an absolute windfall for a bunch of other species of birds. Nope. You guys aren't supposed to be up there yet. There, a bunch of other species of birds. So birds will come and check out these little woodpecker nests, and bluebirds, chickadees, wrens, swallows, a bunch of different species will use these leftover woodpecker nests. And it's a great place to raise a family, except that there is one particularly powerful drawback, and that is that woodpeckers, like a lot of other birds, have parasites on them. So equivalents of bed bugs and mites. These little mites get left behind inside that nest. And when you show up next year as a little bluebird wanting to make your nest there, you go into this thing, there's a whole bunch of hungry mites already there waiting for you. And the populations of these things can build up over time and be really, really stressful if you're trying to raise a bunch of little chicks in there. But there is one species that has figured out an absolutely beautiful way around that, and that is the little house wren right here. Scientists have recently figured out, by spending lots of time sitting on a stump and watching house wrens, that what the wrens do is they'll go around the forest, they're picking up food to eat, and you'll also still see them sometimes flying back to the nest with a large, pale object hanging from their beak. And what they're doing is they're collecting the egg sacs of jumping spiders. And so they decorate the nest with these little egg sacs. The baby jumping spiders hatch in there, and they are just mite size. And they'll stay in there as long as there's a good banquet to eat. So they'll get in there, like little Rottweilers, clean up all of the little mites that are left there in your nest. And when there's not enough for them to eat, they'll just head out the door and be on their merry way. So it's just a beautiful way of doing house cleaning. These jumping spiders are wonderful things, the ideal spiders for doing house cleaning in your house, because they're not building webs everywhere. They are visually oriented hunters. They're not getting vibrations on a web. They don't spin a web. Sometimes they'll leave a little trail line behind them, but generally they're not spinning a web. They see prey, and they crunch down their legs, they beat their heart really fast to shoot blood into their legs and go jumping forward to grab their prey. And with these giant forward-facing eyes, they have two particularly large eyes in front, they're very, very good at catching their prey. They're also very visually stimulated spiders. A lot of them have bright colors on them. And when they, when one jumping spider sees another jumping spider, they will go through these little dances to establish territory or to see if somebody's a prospective mate. So they'll take their legs and they'll wave their legs up and down. They'll take their abdomens and wave them back and forth. And these little objects in front, those are called their pedipalps, the leg-like things. They'll start spinning those around and doing this sort of side-to-side dance. And then you see another jumping spider. You start going into your thing. The jumping spider in front of you starts doing its thing. You figure out, are you the same spider? And you're a little bit bigger than me. I think you win. Or you can figure out if this is a prospective mate. So jumping spiders are, they're really cool things. You can take a little mirror. If you have a little mirror in your camping kit, you know, sometimes people have that little signal mirror that I can never figure out how to use, a little hole in it. You take that, you put it down in front of a jumping spider. If it sees its own reflection, it will just jump into this whole thing. It's really, really cool. They're just wonderful little animals. And they're so just automatic with this that there is a fly in the forest that has figured out how to take advantage of that. And what this little fruit fly does is, a lot of jumping spiders will have stripes on their legs. The fruit fly with stripes on its wings, when it holds them up, they look like little legs sticking down. And so the fruit fly will take its wings, flip its wings up, and start kind of walking side by side like this, right? So it starts doing a jumping spider dance. The jumping spider sees this and goes into its display, starts to really get into it, at which point, the fly is out of there. It's just amazing, amazing, amazing thing. And these flies that fool the jumping spiders, they are then off to find snowberry plants, because the only place that they will lay their eggs is, they're a fruit fly. You know, we remember the med fly and all those sorts of things. The fruit flies lay their eggs in fruit, so this is a native fruit fly that is not an agricultural pest, and it will lay its egg onto the fruit of a snowberry plant. And it only wants to have one egg per fruit. So it's easy enough for you if you just sort of lay one in each. But what if the next fly comes along and does the same thing? Then there's two flies growing up in there, and they're going to be competing with food. So after the fly lays an egg, it turns around and also smears some paints pheromones onto the little snowberry to let the other flies know that this one has already been used. Go someplace else. So a pretty neat system. He heads off, starts hanging out on the snowberry. The snowberry is also home to all sorts of other species. If you start looking around on them very carefully, you can find some little hornworm caterpillars. So caterpillars that look like, did anybody have ever seen a tomato hornworm with that spike on the backside? So a miniature version of that is climbing around on the leaves, eating the leaves of the snowberry plant. And when it's ready to pupate, it lets go, drops down into the leaf litter, turns into a pupa. And then usually a caterpillar turns into what? Butterfly or moth, all right? But out comes this bumblebee. It's actually a moth. It's a clear-winged moth, right? When it first hatches, it's got scales all over its wings. It gives them a couple of shakes, and most of the scales on its wings fall off, leaving transparent membranes. It has fuzzy body like a bumblebee, and it flies at during the day visiting flowers just like a bumblebee. And there's a lot of variation as you go across the United States in this species. And what they seem to be doing is closely mimicking the most common species of butterfly, of bumblebee, in their area. So really, really neat bumblebee mimics. That's running around on that plant. However, if you are in a part of the forest where you also find mounds like this, right, you're not going to find on the snowberry bushes around there any caterpillars. All right? Anybody have a guess what made this mound? Looks like a pack rat mound. All right? Pack rat or beaver. And I heard ants over here. You're actually right. This is an ant mound. It looks like a pack rat mound because of these big sticks, but these big sticks fell from nearby trees. If you walk up to this, it is covered, crawling with ants. And these ants have some really interesting behaviors. On a field trip, I was up in the the Sierra Buttes. Found a great big mound of these. And playing with it with some friends, we discovered that if you get your face down right next to the mound and stick out your tongue, right, a few inches away, and start patting the mound like that, the ants, in response to this, will be taking their abdomens and squirting formic acid up into the air. And they can squirt you about that far away, about a foot away. So they squirt your face. So it's really important to close your eyes very, very tight. Otherwise, it stings like crazy. But when it hits your tongue, it tastes just like super lemon drops because acids, of course, are sour tasting. So you get this acid on your tongue. It tastes like this incredibly sour lemon drop taste. But they're running all over this, shooting acid at you. Really, really cool ants. These ants that make these mounds, this is a big mound here. I'm actually standing up here. These mounds, whenever you find one, it's also a sign that there was some pretty nefarious activity in the forest. Because for every one of these red and black ant mounds that you find, there is a black ant nest that came to a bitter end. Because these ants, the little red and black ones, have figured out a way of getting through the most dangerous part in the life cycle of an ant. And what that is establishing and founding a new colony. You have to do all the work. You need to dig a hole, take care of the kids, lay eggs, all this sort of stuff. I mean, eventually, when you've got lots of workers working for you, life is easy. But for a new queen, establishing a new colony is really difficult. So what she does, the red and black queen, she'll fly out, find herself a little black ant colony, and land next to it. And she waits until she's discovered by a little worker from that colony. And the little worker comes up and says, "You can tell with its antenna that she doesn't smell right. So we'll try to drive her off." So she picks up the little one and rubs it all over herself. What is she doing? Yeah, it's chemical camouflage. She covers herself with the chemical camouflage of this ant until she can walk right down into that nest, past all the rest of the ants in the colony being welcomed as a sister, until she finds her way to the brood chamber, and the queen is there who welcomes her as a sister. Ants do this really beautiful greeting ceremony where they vomit liquid and they eat each other's vomit liquid, and it's a great way of sort of food sharing. So they even do some little food sharing, and then this little red and black queen turns around and stings the black queen, kills her, and begins releasing pheromones that announce to the rest of the black ants in the colony, "You know, your attention, please. You'll be noticing a few changes around the hive, but nothing to be concerned about. Just go about your work. A few red and black sisters, but everything is okay. The government is in control of everything." Right? And they believe it. And so they keep going about their work. They start feeding the red and black sisters, who then happily live in this colony with the black ones until the last black ones die. And the red and black ones begin to make their own new mound. The black ones don't make a mound. Those are made by the red and black ones who have taken over a black ant colony. Really, really cool behavior. So these ants will flood out into the forest every day, go out into the trees, and they are bringing back food for their huge colony, all the little insects that they find in the forest. So if you're near one of these mounds, there's not going to be a lot of insects out here in the trees and bushes around you in the forest. And if you are a lodgepole pine tree, that's a pretty good deal because you have an automatic insect teaming, cleaning team that will come up into your branches every day, and so you're not going to find outbreaks of different sorts of pests and insects in those sorts of trees that are protected by the ant mounds underneath. Absolutely beautiful. So John Muir said that when you try to pick out any one thing by itself, you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. And the more that people study biology and natural history, we just find that's more and more and more and more true in the most amazing ways. And as a community of scientists, people have been able to observe and document only a tiny fraction of the sorts of interactions that species have out there in the forest. Most of the coolest stuff nobody has even thought of, nobody has seen. We have this tiny little window from what we've been able to observe about the way that they're working with each other. And it's absolutely astonishing and beautiful. And I think that that's one of the reasons why studying natural history and teaching it to children and to adults is so important. That the more that we appreciate that, the more wonder we have, the more valuable it is to us, the more willing we'll be to stand up to protect these sorts of things. So I think that helping people appreciate natural history, the biodiversity of what is around them, is really important for several reasons. One, what a joy, what an amazing joy to have this wonder be accessible to you. But also, by so doing, we're building a larger community of stewards to protect these resources. So I think that it is all the more important now that people be aware of what's out there and its value, because as voting, thinking, driving primates, we have a tremendous capacity to affect the systems around us. And the more that we appreciate that responsibility, the more we're going to be willing to do that. This is a little animation made by USGS of a mountain in Glacier Park. And what they've done is mapped the historical plant distribution ranges and ranges of glaciers and taken that through time. And then used that as a predictive model to see what is going to happen down the line. Within our lifetime, those glaciers and glacier are going to disappear. And radical changes in the plant communities around them. The same thing is happening in the Sierra Nevada, right? Happening all over. And it affects all sorts of species, and all sorts of species who can't vote. My personal favorite Sierra Nevada mammal is the pika. You have to earn seeing a pika. You need to climb to the tops of the highest mountains, and you get up there and you hear, eek, eek, right? And you see this tiny little hamster-sized mammal bouncing around from rock to rock with a bouquet of flowers sticking out of their mouth. And these little pikas, they're actually rabbit relatives. They go out during the summertime, they collect plants, they bring them back and make huge mounds of them under protective rocks, and they live on these and in these piles all winter long, eating the taste of last summer. Sort of this bittersweet thing. I think of them sort of in there, kind of, you know, remembering, you know. And it's really neat. They found that they will sometimes collect plants with poisonous alkaloids in them. If they ate those plants, they would die. But those alkaloids also retard decomposition. And as they sit there over time, those alkaloids begin to break down until the point that they're actually edible. And about that same time, they begin to start to spoil. So those are the things you eat at the end of winter. Right? Just amazing, amazing species. But all the research is showing that, you know, we may be saying goodbye to our Sierra Nevada pika. And I think that the more that we appreciate our potential as stewards and are motivated to do the work which we need to do, only good things can come of that. But sometimes, especially when we start thinking about climate changes and all these sorts of things, it can begin to feel, the amount, the size of the task can feel oppressive. And people will sometimes shrink from the task or get overwhelmed by it or burn out because they've been working in that for years. So I have three ideas that I'm going to suggest to you tonight to help you make a difference and continue to make a difference and not get burned out. And the first, I think, is the most important. And that is, on a regular basis, get yourself back out there. And remind yourself of how amazing and beautiful and special these wild places are. If you can't go backpacking anymore, there are lots of accessible places where you can still get right up to high elevation zones. Get yourself over onto the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada and begin to drive up some of those canyons. And even if you can take only a short walk, you are immersed in the most incredible beauty. And that's going to recharge your batteries and remind you of why we do this work. If it's been too long since the last time you actually saw these places, your brain forgets, and it's hard to get yourself to do the work, to write those letters. But if that experience is fresh with you, right, it nourishes you and it helps motivate you to put your hand to pen or to talk to your neighbor. And then there's the second thing. So number one is get yourself out there. Number two, I would suggest bringing somebody with you. Right? Goethe said that a joy shared is a joy doubled. And I think that's very true. Right? But also, by exposing people who haven't already had the opportunity of spending time in nature, I don't think you could give somebody a greater gift, either as an adult or as a child. For me, I was lucky enough to have two parents who regularly brought me out there and exposed me to these things. Right? And what if the next Rachel Carson or John Muir, David Gaines or Shar Smith is that little kid who lives down the street from you and nobody has yet put a pair of binoculars in her hands? And she'll never grow up to be what she otherwise would have become without that. You can change somebody's life just by exposing them to how beautiful and how special it is to go out into nature. You don't need to be a nature guide expert, but being willing to take somebody to these places and let them play in it and enjoy it and discover. People have a lot of worry that, you know, kids these days are just, you know, playing with their digital devices. Nature still works as well as it ever has. You get a kid out there by a stream, and they will actually put down their Game Boy to catch frogs. It still works. Right. So bring somebody else with you. And number three is don't feel alone. Right? All over this state, there is a community of people who also love these things and are working to protect them. And now they are starting to organize with each other. These are just organizations in the Sierra Nevada. Right? They're organizing with each other and networking and figuring out how, as a larger community, we can work to protect these resources. And these are small, feisty, grassroots groups, sometimes no bigger than a little local watershed. But they love their backyard. And they're working to protect it, to find ways. They know that development is coming, but how can we, as an intelligent community, do that sustainably? And what is beautiful about this is it's not just, you know, over the last several years, we have been dividing ourselves more and more along these sort of red state, blue state lines. Right? And if you listen to radio stations, there are people who are happy to tell you about all the reasons that you should be emotionally divided from other people in your community. But stewardship and conservation of these sorts of resources is one of the sorts of things that can bring us all together. One of the only things to pass through our recent Congress with overwhelming bipartisan support was the Wilderness Act that put, 700,000 acres... I'm dyslexic, so I can't remember the numbers. A big number.
Big number.
Of new wilderness. Four new wild and scenic river designations. And this was something that came with overwhelming bipartisan support. It was brought through Congress by, on one side, Barbara Boxer, a Democrat, and the other, Buck McEwen, a Republican. And the two of them helped this beautiful package move through Congress. And everybody bought onto it because we're talking about the stewardship of our planet and our birthright to our children. So this is, I think, one of the things that we can also use as a way of healing this country and the things that for years have been dividing us. Why don't we just find more things that we agree on and work on them? This is one of them. And there's another reason to be hopeful. And that is that joining with these folks, you are not alone. Not just with human beings, but the critters are doing it for you also. This is my favorite photograph. When I was working on my field guide, I had a dilemma of whether or not to put the wolverine in the book. And the reason was, it hadn't been seen alive in the Sierra Nevada since the 20s. Now, you'd hear these reports of them. Some very, very good people were sure they'd seen them, but nobody could get a photograph of them, not even a scat, a track, any of these sorts of things. And so biologists were kind of looking at it with the same sort of skepticism that they give Bigfoot sightings. But these reports came through enough that it really had people wondering, you know, could they actually be there? And so I decided ultimately to put it in my book Because of Hope. And I put in a little footnote with it that said, you know, if you see one of these things, please photograph it and report it to the Department of Fish and Game. Because, you know, we need to know that these things are really out there. And then, about 4 months after my book came out, on February 28th, 2008, this critter clicked the lens on a remote motion-sensitive camera as part of a Pine Marten research study. When the woman who was running that study saw this, she practically fell out of her chair. Because with these big, thick, stumpy legs, this pale stripe that comes down across the body over the top of the tail, so a tail, not a bear, right? And up the other side, there's nothing that this could be but a wolverine in the Sierra Nevada. And then the question became, is this one of these Sierra Nevada wolverines that has remained hidden for the last, well, since, you do the math, since the 1920s? Or is this one who has come all the way from a different part of our country to repopulate the Sierra Nevada with biodiversity? Either way, it's amazing. But they sent every available graduate student out all through the Sierra Nevada. There wasn't a tree up there that didn't get its own personal motion-sensitive camera. And there were teams of graduate students, you know, going out there picking up every scat they could find. And they actually even had teams of wolverine scat-sniffing dogs. Right? So all this went on. And finally, the same woman who identified this from the photograph, she was walking out one day, and she found some tracks. She followed them, and there was a scat. Oh, here's... And what she did was brought that back, and from looking at the scat, you know how in CSI everything is figured out where, you know, we have no idea who did this, but wait, is that a fiber? You know? They got a fiber from this wolverine. And from that, they're able to look at its DNA. And isn't it amazing? This is a male, and this is a male wolverine who has come all the way from the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho. So past farms, freeways, highways, rivers, around the edges of cities and farms, fences. Think how many fences are between here and there. To repopulate the Sierra Nevada with biodiversity. And if it can come that far, nature is doing its part. All right. Here's another batch of pictures of that wolverine. I love this one down here with that little reflection in its eye, glowing bright green, and reminds me of what Alda Leopold said about the fierce green fire. Right? I think that's the best description of wildness, that fierce green fire. And that fierce green fire is not dead in the Sierra Nevada. It is alive and well. Right? It is in the eyes of the wolverine and every steward of nature who is working to preserve the range of light up there. There's a large community of people who are motivated by love to protect those systems. And it's not something where we separate ourselves on political boundaries. It is something for anyone who's ever been touched by that. And I want to thank you folks for coming tonight. I want to encourage everybody here in this room to get yourself back out into those mountains. John Muir said, climb the mountains and get their glad tidings. Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees. The storms will blow their energy into you and the winds their freshness as cares drift away like autumn leaves. And you will come away refreshed and alive and reminded of how beautiful and sacred this planet is. Bring somebody with you. Share your love with them. And join with a community of other people who are working to protect these things. And don't feel overwhelmed. We are an incredibly intelligent ape, and we have shown time and time again that we actually can work in our better interest and to do the right thing when we work together in a community. And I think that this is one of those things that we can really come together around. So thank you for coming tonight.
Inspirational. I'm sure you have some questions.
Yes?
Just raise your hand and I'll pass this around.
I'll use this one here.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about the artistic process, where you got your specimens, how you went about learning to be an artist and that sort of thing?
You bet. My original inspiration to do artwork was my grandmother, Beatrice Chalice, and whom my mom is named after. And she was a watercolorist, and she just put materials into my hands and just encouraged me to play with them. There weren't rules. Just enjoy it and play with it and keep doing it. And anytime I'd do something, she'd put that picture up on the wall of her, she'd frame it and put it up in her kitchen. And it eventually became this giant gallery, kind of like we got going in here in this room. But it was all just there in Grandma's kitchen, and I wanted to get more stuff on that wall, and I just kept drawing and drawing and drawing. And as my interest in natural history grew, so did my interest in drawing. And I made lots of my field notes as sketches because I'm dyslexic, and writing was more difficult for me. So a lot of what I did was I would just draw what I saw. And with anything that you do more and more and more of, it gets better. My practice was just making all those field sketches. And because I wasn't worried about having to make it look pretty or make it right, I just wanted to document what I saw. I could do a lot of drawings without that kind of inner art critic that sometimes shows up and goes, that doesn't look like a warbler. What are you doing? All right? I just wanted to help myself remember and to help myself look more carefully. So the more that I did, the better that got. I also, before I started this program, I went to UC Santa Cruz and studied scientific illustration there. They had a terrific scientific illustration program that's now moved to Cal State Monterey Bay. My process in the field was really fun. Part of it was this fantasy of spending all these summers in the Sierra backpacking around and painting flowers. So think about it. This is your job. You're going to put your backpack on, hike down the trail until you find a flower you haven't painted yet, sit down next to it, key it out, have lunch, paint it, put your backpack on, keep walking until you find the next one. You do that all day. You wake up the next day, you do the same thing. You wake up next day, you do the same thing. Sometimes I'd take a road trip and my dad would join me. Sometimes my mom would join me. It was a chance to just visit these amazing places. Or sometimes I'd just be out for a few weeks romping around and come back with a big pile of pictures once I ran out of food and paper. Then back down to the Bay Area, pay the phone bill, head back up to the mountains, paint and paint and paint and paint. And fortunately, I was able to get some grants to help me do it. In particular, a terrific grant from the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Fund that helped make it possible. Because a guy needs to, you know, get black beans to power him through something like this. All the plants I did from life in the field. for the birds, I'd be out there, the birds, the mammals, and those sorts of things, they don't sit still. And so I would, in the field, make careful sketches of what I saw and then use those as a source of reference material and bring them back down to San Francisco. And in the wintertime, when the snows would bump me out of the mountains, I would go to the California Academy of Sciences. And behind the scenes there is this fully functioning research museum with millions and millions of specimens from all over the world. And their California collections are astounding. So I'd want to see, you know, what does this species of bird look like in this season, in this part of the Sierra? Well, which of the four drawers do you want to look through of those? And so you'd, you know, pull them out and look through them and get this sort of overall gestalt of what those look like and how do they differ, and use those resources to help me draw the feather-by-feather detail for those sorts of drawings. So between the live things in the field and the resources of the California Academy of Sciences, that made that possible.
As to your theatrical skills, do they just come naturally, or have you had some training?
So, for anybody listening to the recording, you missed the spider dance.
Missed the movement, right.
I haven't done much theater training. When I was in high school, I was Dick Deadeye in the HMS Pinafore. But that's about the extent of it. But I've always kind of been a ham and just like goofing around. And I've also spent a lot of time teaching children. Sometimes you got to jump up and down and stand on your head. And I still do that even when I'm in the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you so much for this really great presentation. I've been to a lot of these, and this is really one of the best. But I'm just intrigued with your name. So many people say that your name is destiny, and I'm just wondering if, you know, could you ever see yourself as anything other than what you've become? I mean, I can't imagine you as a Wall Street banker or something like that.
The dyslexic Wall Street banker would also be interesting. I would be responsible for my own financial scandals, but they would all be by an accident. My mom and dad named me John Muir Laws, so I didn't change that book, that name, just to write a book about the Sierra Nevada. But I'm actually not related to the John Muir that you think I'm related to. The John actually comes from my grandfather on one side of the family, and my Muir is the great grandmother on the other side of my family. But my parents liked the way those two came together. They were both spent a lot of time, their whole courtship and romance was romping around in the Sierra Nevada. I think my mom really knew that my dad was the right guy when he waded into a frozen Sierra lake to get her fly off of a fly fishing fly off of a log that it was snagged on. And they did like the way those two came together. And the whole time, if you're named John Muir and you're a kid, you know, you can't make sense of what's a second cousin, all this sort of stuff. I knew I'm one way or another, I must be related to this guy because every birthday people give you John Muir books. So I just grew up with all those stories and the climbing the tree and the, all these sorts of things. So that was always there. So that, and I think coupled with just the chance to be exposed to it and to absorb it at my own pace. Made a huge difference for me.
Thank you for a fantastic speak. What's your next project?
Well, right now I'm working on several things that I'm having a lot of fun with. Some of the pictures in this room are from a book that I'm writing to help people learn how to draw birds. And that's fairly close to completion. But I'm also writing a similar field guide to coastal California and the adjacent coast ranges. So I'm thinking perhaps the boundaries of it are still in flux, and part of it's going to depend on really studying the floristic provinces, but perhaps from Big Sur up through Mendocino, that region and the adjacent coast ranges, so all over the Bay Area here, to help people appreciate the biodiversity that's right here in our backyard. And it's even a more diverse area than the Sierra Nevada. There's just incredible stuff right around here. I'm also working on, with the California Native Plant Society, to create a curriculum for students to help teachers figure out ways to get their students drawing and sketching what they see in nature as a way to help them look more carefully. Use it as a tool for observation and how to get over the fear of drawing and just do it to see more. And I'm also working with schools in the Sierra Nevada to teach kids about their backyard biodiversity. And I'm also giving, as part of that same project, giving sets of 25 field guides to each school, so there will be a teaching set of those in the classroom. So a teacher who's taking their kids outdoors can put a field guide in every kid's hand. I know I was a field guide junkie when I was a kid. I remember the day my dad gave me a pile of my dream field guides up at the Audubon Canyon Ranch. And, you know, that night, I don't know if I slept at all because I was just there underneath my covers with the reading through the books. It was just all this, you know, all these things that I had the potential to see and potential to discover. I want to get other kids excited about those sort of things. That's maybe one reason why I put in so many bugs, right? I want to inspire kids to look more carefully. And adults, too. My dad once said this, and it's stuck with me ever since, that once you kind of know these flowers and things, you see them again the next season. It's like seeing an old friend again. And it's like, oh, I remember you. I remember the last time I saw you and where I was and who I was with. And it just makes the world richer to be in.
Any other questions? Okay.
Again, congratulations, and your theatrics are fine in an audio format, so very good. I met an old forester at a piano tuner's convention, and he gave a lecture on woods and how to treat various different kinds of woods, and he was a wood carver and so forth, and he claimed that wood and burning wood is the only true renewable energy resource. And I thought that was a strange way to look at wood. But it was his contention that if we grew a lot of wood, we would have a renewable source that beats oil and coal and so forth. Do you have an opinion on that? And was he crazy with age or something?
Most people with age just get smarter and smarter, so I wouldn't dare to cross swords with him. I know there's lots of folks thinking about ways that with you know biofuels and these sorts of things that plants can be used for energy. And then there's questions of, is that going to then impact plants that are used as food? I have not studied those areas enough to give a really informed, intelligent answer. But I think that it's a really important thing to be looking at. And I'd say not just wood, but other species of plants as well. There are some things that grow that turn carbon in the atmosphere into carbon in plants at a really, really fast rate. That's also fuel. So I would expand his idea beyond wood. There's a lot of other plants that are wanting to team in there and help with the wood. But I do not consider myself informed enough about it to give you anything more concrete than that. But that's a really interesting question, sir.
This was a really engaging and great and optimistic presentation. I really thank you for it. And on the optimism note, I'm wondering if since the wolverine was seen, if there's been any evidence of him having a girlfriend.
That is the million-dollar question. Since that Wolverine has been seen, it has showed up every year since. Seems to be the same Wolverine. It doesn't seem to be a Wolverine that was somebody's pet and released. Whoever would have a Wolverine pet, I don't know, but they'd be pretty tough. It stays completely away from people. It's not habituated to people. It seems to like the chickens that biologists tie to trees. So it's actually been a glutton for getting attention on film. I'm actually going to bring up for you. This is particularly fun. It also ended up showing up on a video. And so here's the new Wolverine movie, and I'm not talking about the X-Men. Let's see here. Open recent. It's the only thing. There we go. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your Sierra Nevada Wolverine in action. And just watch this thing move. It's beautiful. It's just so strong. There's this one. It does this. Here it's going to do its lumbering gait. It's just like it is more muscular than Arnold. Look at that. Oh, isn't that cool? It's a beautiful thing. And the question is, you know, is this wonderful animal out there all alone? Does it have a girlfriend? There have been other reported but not documented Wolverines in the Sierra Nevada. Partway through my project, I got a phone call from a fellow who is sort of the Wolverine, you know, the top Wolverine or mustelid weasel researcher in California, and he told me about a place where a backcountry ranger had spent several days in the southern Sierra observing what he was sure was a. This is before this thing was before all this filming. Was sure was a Wolverine and its baby hunting marmots around a rock pile over a course of a couple of days. But he didn't have a camera. And so I went into that area with motion-sensitive cameras that he loaned me and these little vials of liquid that were made from the secretions of the musk glands of weasels. So think like skunk spray in a bottle. And one of those did open in my backpack, but that's another story. But that aside, I set these things up all over that area and scented all these rocks and sort of figured, like, if I were a Wolverine, I would come down this draw, I would smell this, and then here's where, you know, I had a lot of fun like that. When I got back, I ended up having a picture, I think, of the back end of a marmot and my boot as I was trying to set these things up. And I never saw the Wolverine, if there was one there. But just knowing that one could be there made that whole valley feel different to me. And just the possibility that I was sharing that canyon with a Wolverine just made the hair stand up on the back of my neck in a beautiful way. And I like to think that she's out there. But I don't know. They are really, really tough, except for this Wolverine, who seems to love the camera. Here it is again. This one seems to love the camera, but usually it's really hard to document if a Wolverine is there. There are some places where to see if there are Wolverines around, they have to take helicopters around in winter and dump deer carcasses out the window and then come back by chopper later on and see the tracks that are in this area. You have to go to sort of great lengths with helicopters and dead deer. I don't know. It's possible. And if so, is that one of the original Californians? It's possible, but I don't know. I think a Wolverine reintroduction project would be even more logistically difficult than a wolf reintroduction project. But I think, you know, hey, if one got here on its own, we ought to give that guy some support. So I think he needs a friend. Yeah, But I feel sorry for the biologists who are going to try to do that. You know, trapping a wolverine is just a fool's endeavor. They make these log cabins with reinforcement, logs this big that to try to temporarily hold a wolverine. And if the wolverine stays in this for more than a day, they'll just rip the cage apart and go on their merry wolverine way. You know, you've heard of wolves like chewing off their leg, right? The wolverine will like cut down the tree, you know. they're tough critters. And reintroducing them would be logistically a nightmare. But I love the idea. And how amazing. Think of that thing coming all the way from the Sawtooth Mountains. Nature is doing its part. Nature is doing its part to step up to the plate and preserve the biodiversity of this planet. And we're part of that. We're a part of nature. We got to do our part, too, and join in that effort. And we're not alone. Wolverine is part of our posse.
That's a great note to stop on. Thank you, Jack.
Hey, everybody, thank you for coming tonight. Thank you very much.
And you'll be here to sign some books if anyone.
Yep. Thank you all. If anybody would like, I'd be happy to sign a book for you or a kid you know.
Okay, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.